The House comes to oral questions. Dr. Shane Rettig.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all of her government's statements and actions?
The Honourable Speaker. Grant Robertson.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes. In particular, I stand by this government's ability to deliver for New Zealanders and continue our strong economic recovery. Mr. Speaker, today we have increased main benefits by an initial $20 per week per person, providing more support for 355,000 New Zealanders. We've reinstated the training incentive allowance, which was cut by the previous National Government. We have today launched the Ministry for Ethnic Communities. We have increased paid parental leave to a maximum of $621.76 per week. We have extended the unsupported child benefit and orphan benefit for short-term caregivers. And, Mr. Speaker, launched our new rebates for electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles. Mr. Speaker, this is just some of a long list of initiatives that the government is delivering on.
Supplementary. Do the current child poverty results reflect the fact a key policy tool is benefit increases that are being cancelled out by the soaring cost of living?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Dimitri, why is one of her new three-year child poverty reduction targets exactly the same target she previously set and is pushing that out by 3 years in admission of failure of one of her primary targets?
Answer the second part of the question, no. Mr. Speaker, we are on track to meet the 10-year targets. The initial three-year targets that were set were ambitious. We have now made further three-year targets, but we are on track for the 10-year targets.
Petrie, how has the $100 a week increase in rents since she became Prime Minister affected the likelihood this year of her achieving all of the first set of child poverty targets?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Prime Minister, what I do know is that on all nine indicators around child poverty, we have seen good progress under this government. The government has never denied that there is more to do, but the significant investments we've made in lifting the income of the lowest income New Zealanders is making a significant difference in lifting children out of poverty.
Entry. Why are there 1,500 more children living in poverty on the government's primary measure A compared to when she took office in 2017?
Speaker, the member is wrong. As he said in his press release yesterday, he was wrong then as well. If he takes the measure from the correct date, where we are measuring on what this government is responsible for, we've in fact seen 25,000 fewer children in poverty.
Supplementary. When does she plan to achieve the target of lifting 100,000 children out of poverty, given from when they've come into government, there are 1,500 more children living in poverty on one measure?
The member, as I said in my last supplementary answer, is wrong on that matter.
Speaker.
Question number two, Irene Williams.
My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
The Honourable Speaker. Grant Robertson.
The government's ongoing support to secure the economic recovery is being reflected in the Crown's financial accounts. The Crown accounts for the 11 months to the end of May 2021 were released today, and they show that the operating balance before gains and losses, the OBGAL, was a deficit of $3.6 billion. That is $5.8 billion better than was forecast by the Treasury in Budget 2021. Net core Crown debt stood at 31.2% of GDP, $6 billion less than forecast. Mr. Speaker, while the government's books are in better shape than expected, we cannot afford to be complacent. We are still facing elevated levels of debt and OBGAL deficit for some years to come as a result of the response that was needed to the pandemic.
What is the impact of the economy on the country's tax take?
Mr. Speaker, New Zealanders' confidence in the recovery has been confirmed via an increase in tax revenue. Tax revenue was $89 billion in the 11 months to the end of May 2021, $4.1 billion above forecast. The improvement was across the board, with corporate tax being 13.7% higher than expected, source deductions revenue up 2% on forecast, and GST up 2.5%. The Treasury notes that the positive variances reflect economic conditions being better than forecasts. In simple terms, Mr. Speaker, businesses are benefiting from New Zealanders buying their goods and services, which allow them to employ people, which in turn boosts spending in the economy. Nevertheless, the outlook does remain uncertain. The recent case of the Australian traveller in Wellington with COVID-19 and Australia's growing outbreak, which has prompted the alert level rises, are signs that a resurgence in COVID cases around the world can make the economic environment more volatile, and we need to be cautious in response to that.
What constraints are there on the economy during the pandemic?
Speaker, the economy's performance has exceeded the expectations of most, but the recovery does remain uneven for some sectors and regions in New Zealand. There are supply chain issues which, while mainly global in nature, are affecting the economy. The balanced approach that we took in Budget 2021 is appropriate as we work through the uncertainty. We will continue to keep a lid on debt while targeting support where it is needed most to accelerate our recovery and tackle those long-standing issues around climate change, housing and child wellbeing.
Question number three, Simon Court.
To the Minister of Transport. What estimates, if any, has he been provided by officials on the cost of cutting greenhouse gas emissions through the Clean Car Package?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr Speaker, I thank the member for his excellent and timely question. The Clean Car Discount Scheme alone is expected to prevent up to 9.2 million tonnes of carbon dioxide emissions by 2050. The expected marginal abatement cost for the Clean Car Discount and Clean Car Standard combined is estimated at minus $160 to minus $200 per tonne of carbon emissions prevented. The estimates are negative, meaning that they represent a net benefit to the New Zealand economy due to large fuel savings for New Zealanders. In short, the policy will reduce emissions, clean up air quality, save Kiwis money and reduce our reliance on volatile international fuel supply chains. No doubt the ACT Party opposes it.
Supplementary. What additional carbon emissions will be reduced by the Clean Car Package that would not otherwise have been captured under the Emissions Trading Scheme cap?
Mr Speaker, when the Emissions Trading Scheme was established by a previous Labor government, it was never envisaged that there would never be any specific measures to support New Zealanders to reduce their emissions. I do note that the analysis that has been provided shows that if we relied solely on the price of carbon to achieve the same kind of EV level uptakes as we will achieve through the Clean Car Discounts, then we would need to increase the price of carbon to approximately $575 per tonne, meaning an extra $1.30 per litre on petrol prices. If the member wants to campaign on that policy, then he's very welcome to do so.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker. The Minister's quoted a now-debunked Ministry of Transport report.
Order,
on...
Order. The member will ask a question and will not make an assertion. I'll let him start again, but since the last time I'm going to let him do that.
So where does the Minister get his figures on the negative cost of carbon from?
From the regulatory impact statement.
Further supplementary. So how does that compare with the cost of reducing carbon emissions through the emissions trading scheme?
Well, Mr Speaker, as I just outlined in my previous answer, if we relied solely on the emissions trading scheme and the price of carbon to achieve the same uptake of electric vehicles, we would have to price carbon at approximately $575 per tonne compared to the current level of approximately $40 per tonne. That would be an extra $1.30 per litre on the price of petrol. That is not this government's policy.
Question number four, Dr. Emily Henderson.
My question is to the Minister for Local Government. What specific advice has she seen about the benefits of the Three Waters reform approach for
order,
cities?
Order. I'm going to ask the member to ask the question as it is written on, and I'm just double checking, yes, on the yellow sheet.
My apologies. My question is to the Minister for Local Government. What advice has she seen about the benefits of the Three Waters Programme approach for cities such as Whangarei and Auckland?
Honourable Nanaimo Hutta.
I've seen hundreds of pages of detailed modelling and research that shows all communities in New Zealand, including Auckland and Whangarei, will be better off under the Three Waters reform proposals. It's surprising to hear local mayors not supporting the reforms, given that yesterday I released council-specific information that showed that average household cost per annum in 2051 in Auckland of $1,910 would be reduced to $800. And then in Whangarei, they would be reduced from $4,060 to $800. But that's
order.
Not all, Mr Speaker.
No, The member's a bit lucky. As I've indicated yesterday, I have received a lot of complaints recently about noise from the opposition drowning out ministers making replies. That was another case of that, and it will stop. Interjections are meant to be rare and reasonable. Those interjections weren't. And I say to Mr. Goldsmith, he came very close then. A point of order, Matt
Mr. Speaker, yesterday the opposition sat through the Prime Minister chipping our questioners while they're asking their primary questions. Can I ask for some balance?
I might balance it by applying the rules, but I won't at the moment because I prefer the member stayed in the House. The Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Mr. Speaker, just to recap, in Whangarei, average household costs per annum would be reduced from $4,060 to $800. But that's not all, Mr. Speaker. In Auckland, they will also receive better quality services and address the major water services issues that have been outlined in my most recent correspondence to Mayor Gough.
Supplementary. Is cross-subsidisation a valid concern, and what benefits would accrue for an entity included the Far North, Whangarei and Kaipara District Councils with Auckland City Council?
Mr. Speaker, the extensive modelling and research which we published yesterday shows that Aucklanders will be better off under the reforms, even after joining up with Northland communities. I've heard calls from Mayor Gough, and it's surprising to hear them, given the number of times the government and the rest of New Zealand has stepped in to support Auckland's shortfalls on infrastructure investment in the past. The real issue for Auckland is their constrained balance sheets and operational inefficiencies when compared to water entities of the same scale. As a government, we simply want Aucklanders to save money, have access to safe water and be able to go to their beaches and swim safely. Aucklanders want all of this. I would have thought that Mayor Gough would have wanted it too.
Supplementary. Is she concerned that councils such as Whangarei and Auckland have signalled that they are not supporting the proposed Three Waters reform?
Mr. Speaker, I've released significant information yesterday on the specific benefits to Whangarei and Auckland and all other New Zealand communities for their ratepayers and water users through the reforms. I urge those councils to take the time to digest their information and share it with their residents, ratepayers and householders. We need to continue to work together on this reform program to ensure the delivery of these vital infrastructure services have the very best chance of success. Even though the benefits of reform to its residents are very clear, I do acknowledge that Whangarei is one of the very few councils in this country with very little debt. We're working with Local Government New Zealand to address the specific situation and to put together an approach to support councils on these reforms. Mr. Speaker, point of order.
Yeah, point of order.
No. Bob. I'm happy to take a question.
Well, member has to sit down if she's going to take a question. The Honourable Chris Luxon.
Supplementary. Will she rule out forcing and mandating councils to participate in the Three Waters reforms?
Mr. Speaker, as I said previously, I've encouraged councils to ensure they have the full suite of information and research and modelling to be able to make a decision so they can see the benefits of reform and understand them and then explain those benefits back to ratepayers. I'm sure all councils will want to be in that position prior to predetermining an outcome that might ultimately negatively impact ratepayers.
Point of order, Speaker.
I seek leave to table a letter and associated information related to Auckland and Whangarei. The letter is to Mayor Gough, my most recent one.
One of your letters, a letter that
yes.
You've sent. Is there any objection to that letter being tabled? There appears to be none. Question number 5, the Honourable Michael Waterhouse.
Point of order.
A point of order, Chris Bishop.
I just want to query you on your statement that you just made in the middle of that question around significant feedback from members of the public around the behaviour of the opposition during question time. You said that you'd made that point yesterday. I've looked back at what you actually said yesterday, sir, and you said that you made a very general remark in which you said that you'd received significantly more public reaction to misbehaviour in the House than I've had for some time, which at least implied, or at least explicitly said, all of the House was to blame. And you now seem to be saying, sir, that basically it's the National Party's opposition's fault. And I put it to you, sir, that when there is disorder in the House or misbehaviour, it occurs not just from the National Party opposition, but from Labor members frequently using supplementary questions to take political flicks at the opposition, which of course will produce elements of disorder, and frequently, as has been pointed out by the Chief Whip for National, using the opportunity of the asking of supplementary questions to take flicks at the opposition.
Okay, well, this is fairly easy to deal with. The first thing is, if the member doesn't like replies from the government where they feel that supplementaries are being used inappropriately, then the member should bring it up at the time, not days later or the following week. Order. Does the member want to stay? The other point that I'll make is that yesterday I was more generous than I was today as to the source of the or the reason for the complaints that I had been receiving. In fact, if I had to identify one person for being the source of the loud noise, which was the subject of complaint, he's not currently here, but it's a former member for Hamilton East. Mr. Bennett. Question number five, the Honourable Michael.
Point of order. Mr. Speaker, your final comment was out of order. We are rebuked often for referring to the absence of a member from the House, which is exactly what you just did.
I apologise. I was looking for the member. I shouldn't have referred to his absence. I don't like criticising members in their absence, but as far as that particular member is concerned, his repeated inane interjections are the subject of correspondence to me.
We're going to get ourselves into a difficult situation here, Mr. Speaker, because is it now the case that if you agree with the correspondence into your office from members of the public, and by the way, we have no way of verifying the veracity of that correspondence, you will...
Right, member will take a seat. That's the end of that. Thank you. Question number five, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does he stand by all of his statements and actions?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to do that. I'm now going to go back and Chris Bishop will withdraw and apologise for his reflection on the chair.
I'll withdraw and apologise.
No, Michael Wood.
Mr. Speaker, yes, particularly when I said earlier that the Clean Car Discount Scheme alone is expected to prevent up to 9.2 million tonnes of carbon dioxide emissions up to 2050. As I've covered in the House today, the marginal abatement cost of that is -$160 to -$200 per year, representing a net economic saving to New Zealand, which breaks down at the individual level to savings of approximately $7,000 over the lifetime of a clean vehicle that this policy helps Kiwis get into.
Minister, what does he consider to be worst use of taxpayer money? The $125 per passenger trip subsidy for a train from Hamilton to Papakura, or the $2,200 subsidy per
Order.
EV...
Order! Order! Sorry, it's mainly Mr Mitchell now, I think. Can the member start his question again?
Gladly. Which does he consider is the worst use of taxpayer money? The $125 per passenger trip subsidy for a train from Hamilton to Papakura, or the $2,200 subsidy per EV being sent to Japanese exporters?
Speaker, I fundamentally reject the calculations in the member's question. As I've just outlined, the net economic value of the Clean Car Discount Scheme is a positive one to New Zealand, not a negative one.
Does he agree with Vehicle Importers Association CEO David Vinson that the Clean Car Scheme is, quote, virtue signalling on a grand scale and at huge costs, end quote?
Mr. Speaker, but I do agree with the comments of David Crawford from the Motor Industry Association, who says that he's delighted by the announcement, and the comments of the Automobile Association, who say that it's a very well-balanced policy.
When he announced another 6-month consultation on light rail just 3 months ago, was it his understanding half of those 6 months would be spent doing nothing but designing a website and a map?
Mr Speaker, again, I reject the assertions in the member's question. In the space of approximately 2 months, the light rail establishment unit has now gone underway with producing an indicative business case, which will inform Cabinet decision-making later in the year, and as of today has launched a major public consultation with the people of Auckland about how we finally take action to unclog Auckland's roads, something that has been ignored for far too long.
Minister, does his need to seek social licence after 4 years of delay on light rail extend to the $785 million cycle bridge? And if so, when can we expect to see a website with a map for that project?
Mr Speaker, there will of course on any significant transport project be engagement and consultation with the public, but I would urge the member as he engages with these projects to stop the sniping and actually to get on with the job that we all have ahead of us, which is to work out how we actually decarbonise New Zealand's transport system, something that that member says in principle that he supports but opposes every single measure that will actually deliver it.
Question number 16, now to Eleanor.
To the Minister of Foreign Affairs, what policies for regulating seabed mining in the Pacific, if any, is New Zealand promoting in its engagement with the International Seabed Authority?
Mr Speaker, New Zealand is actively engaged as a member of the International Seabed Authority, ISA, in the development of a regulatory framework to govern seabed mining. The member may be aware that New Zealand is one of the few countries to have a robust regulatory framework to govern seabed mining within our national jurisdiction, and we're drawing on our experience as we contribute to the development of the International Mining Code. In the Pacific, attitudes towards deep sea mining are mixed. New Zealand does not take a position for or against mining on the seabed within the jurisdiction of Pacific Island countries. We respect the mana and sovereignty of these governments. However, we continue to engage with ISA and call for robust legal frameworks, effective governance structures and high standards of environmental protection. We need to work together with all our partners to advocate for a regulatory framework that provides for a high level of environmental protection. Over recent years, New Zealand has made several submissions to ISA to this effect and will be submitting a further contribution this week.
What is the government's view on Nauru triggering a rule at the International Seabed Authority which will allow seabed mining in Pacific waters by 2023?
Mr Speaker, Nauru's decision to trigger the two-year rule at a time when the International Seabed Authority cannot meet in person as a result of COVID has been expressed by New Zealand as unwelcome and presents a challenge because of the COVID circumstance. New Zealand will, however, continue to engage within the ISA and will redouble our efforts to ensure seabed mining does not occur unless high standards of environmental protection are met. To this end, we'll work closely with Nauru, other partners in the ISA area and those sponsoring mining activities. A rushed process during the pandemic risks an inadequate mining code that does not appropriately protect the environment. This would undermine the reputation of the ISA and galvanise opposition to deep sea mining. In-person meetings will be important to finalise the mining code.
In the preparation of New Zealand's latest submission to the International Seabed Authority on Saturday, has MFAT consulted with representatives of the Pacific Blue Line, a coalition of organisations seeking a ban on deep sea mining? If not, why not?
Thank you for this particular question. As I sought advice on the very issue of engagement, understanding that it would be important from a New Zealand perspective, New Zealand's developed its contributions within the ISA through consultations with a range of relevant government agencies and stakeholders. Public stakeholders, including Māori stakeholders with a known interest in oceans issues, have been invited to provide comment on draft elements of the mining code to inform New Zealand's submissions. In particular, comments have been received from a number of stakeholders, including Greenpeace and the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. Ministry officials have met with representatives of both organisations to discuss this issue and make it a part of our submission.
The Honourable Eugenie Sage.
What specific environmental protections is the New Zealand Government seeking in the International Seabed Authority's framework to regulate deep sea mining? We're committed, Mr Speaker, we're committed to ensuring that the ISA adopts a robust mining code that provides for a high standard of environmental protection in all deep sea mining, including the application of the precautionary approach. This is consistent with the requirements of UNCLOS, which requires the International Seabed Authority to develop a regulatory framework that ensures the effective protection of the marine environment from harmful effects that may arise from deep sea mining.
Will the Minister support international calls for a moratorium on deep sea mining?
Mr Speaker, we're acutely aware of the environmental risks associated with deep sea mining. As a member of ISA, New Zealand is working to ensure that deep sea mining cannot take place and these high standards of environmental protection can be met. With regards to our advocacy within the ISA, New Zealand has continually engaged on the development of its draft regulatory framework for the exploitation of seabed minerals in the area, including submissions in 2015, 2016, 2017, 18, 19 and 20. We will submit a further contribution this week. We urge any country considering deep sea mining to ensure it is only done subject to robust legal frameworks, effective governance structures and high standards of environmental protection. We do this mindful that New Zealand's own regulatory framework allows for deep sea mining under certain conditions and subject to robust regulatory control.
Question number 7, Maya Lubick.
Yeah, Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety and asks, what workplace relations and safety policies come into effect from 1 July?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr Speaker, our government is delivering on a range of commitments to support working New Zealanders from the 1st of July. We recognise that we needed to support security guards given that they are on the front lines in keeping our managed isolation facility secure and doing other important work around our country. That's why I'm pleased to confirm that as of today, security guards have been added to Schedule 1 of the Employment Relations Act, helping to protect their employment conditions.
Supplementary. What effect will this have on the industry?
With these new protections, the 7,800 security guards nationwide will be able to keep their jobs and retain their pay rates and conditions when a business is sold or restructured. This will help stop the race to the bottom where companies are undercutting each other and lead to an industry that competes on service quality, which helps the companies already offering good conditions.
Supplementary, what other changes have started today?
Mr Speaker, today also marks 1 year of paid parental leave being boosted to 26 weeks. So it's a good time that the maximum rate for eligible employees and self-employed people will increase to $621.76 this week from $606.46 per week in the previous year. We're also delivering on our commitment to support the welfare of seafarers by putting seafarer welfare centres onto a sustainable funding footing. These changes show, Mr Speaker, that the government is committed to decent and dignified work for everyone in New Zealand.
That's right. Question number 8, the Honourable Simon Bridges.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice. Does he stand by all his statements and policies on his proposed hate speech law changes?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, yes, because this is a very important issue. It's been raised for a number of years and now most recently by the Royal Commission of Inquiry report on the terrorist attack on the Christchurch mosques. And also because in previous national debates on this issue, that member himself said that we needed to have this conversation, and so we look forward to a constructive, mature debate nationwide.
Well, in light of that answer that's been raised for a number of years, is the government progressing these hate speech changes because it's actually just something they want to do, not because of anything in the Royal Commission report?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, no. The Royal Commission, having inquired into the background events to the terrorist attack on the Christchurch mosques, having spoken to many, many communities, minority ethnic communities and minority faith communities, and heard their experiences and reflected on those experiences and the sorts of expressions that members of those communities come up against every day in the community and in the nation's schoolyards, made a recommendation that it was time to revisit the existing law on hate speech, Section 131 of the Human Rights Act, to update it and align it not only with our international obligations but also with like-minded countries.
Given his statements to the House yesterday that, quote, The proposals in the discussion document maintain the thresholds for incitement of hate speech as they currently stand and look to narrow the definition of hatred, end quote. Why did he say in the introduction to that document itself that he is proposing changes to hate speech law which, quote, strengthen Human Rights Act protections?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, anything that makes the law clearer and more accessible to citizens of this country and those called upon to enforce it is strengthening the law.
Is the government trying to maintain, as he said in this question time, actually in answer to the first primary, or strengthen, as he's just said, hate speech protections in New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, as I said in my previous answer, making the law clearer and making it more accessible to people is strengthening the law. If what he's asking in relation to maintaining the law, maintaining current thresholds and the safeguards and protections that are in the existing law, those will continue. And those safeguards include that there can be no prosecution for hate speech unless it is approved by the Attorney General.
In light of his view just now that he is effectively strengthening the law, how many more police prosecutions and convictions does he estimate, and will he be resourcing, or the government rather, be resourcing up the police accordingly?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, making the law clearer and more accessible does not necessitate an increase in charges or prosecutions of that particular law. It is about sending a very clear signal, as the Royal Commission recommended following its extensive engagement with minority ethnic and faith communities, that we need to do something better than we have at the moment.
So is he now saying he's just making it clearer and not strengthening it?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, no, the Member clearly hasn't listened to my earlier answers. Making the law clearer and more accessible is strengthening the law. It doesn't change the thresholds, the prosecutorial thresholds, or the thresholds that judges will apply in relation to a prosecution.
Isn't the reality that he is clearly proposing to lower the legal threshold and broaden the law of hate speech by, for example, adding in words like maintaining and normalising?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Member, no, the Member is completely wrong. And the Royal Commission, in its analysis of its proposal, was very clear. It did not accept that words like excite, for example, meant a great deal in modern vernacular. It looked to comparable jurisdictions like the United Kingdom and found that language that is more consistent with people's everyday use, like maintaining hatred against others, bearing in mind that any prosecution would have to be on the basis that that is an intended action, and would have the further safeguard of the Attorney-General having to approve any such prosecution, the law and the thresholds that it has to meet would not change.
Question number 9, Sarah Pellin.
Mr Speaker. Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister for Health and asks, what announcements has she made about community maternity services?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Dr Aisha Verrill.
Yesterday, I announced changes to the way community midwives are paid to better reflect the challenges they face providing care and support to mothers and whānau. Community midwives are paid through what is known as the Primary Maternity Services Notice. The previous notice was introduced in 2007, was out of date and provided no compensation for the additional time and travel required of some maternity care providers. This created an unsustainable business model for maternity in rural and highly deprived communities and barriers to access. The new notice is more flexible and will provide greater funding to midwives working in more remote parts of New Zealand and when they are supporting mothers and whānau with complex clinical or social needs.
Supplementary. How will the new notice better support community midwives and the communities they serve?
Mr Speaker, midwives do an incredibly important job and they deserve to be backed up by a strong maternity system that makes it easier for them to do their jobs. The 2021 notice introduces rural practice, travel and additional care payments to more equitably fund travel and provision of maternity care. This will help improve the sustainability of community-based primary maternity services and has been welcomed by the College of Midwives.
Supplementary. What else is being done to strengthen maternity services?
Mr. Speaker, Budget 2020 included the largest ever funding boost for primary maternity services. The government invested $242 million over 4 years so maternity service providers, mothers and their babies can receive more support. In the last year, we've expanded the Maternity Quality and Safety Program in every DHB. We have updated National Maternity Clinical Guidance and invested in information technology system improvements. And we have put $6 million into Te Ara Ohine, an initiative designed to help attract and retain more Māori and Pacifica midwives into the profession by better supporting students in their studies. Mr. Speaker, there is more work to do to strengthen our maternity services, but we are laying the foundations of a better future.
Question number 10, Debbie Naruapaka.
Thank you. To the Minister for Children, does he agree with all Oranga Tamariki's statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker, David. No. I especially do not stand by the actions of staff members who are shown to have used unacceptable behaviour when restraining children in one of our care and protection residences. But I'm not the only one that does not stand by those actions. This morning, the Chief Executive of Oranga Tamariki, Sir Wira Gardner, announced his intention to close the residence here, Oranga, until the investigations are completed. I stand by his action because it was made in the best interests of the children in our care.
Does he agree with the statement of his Chief Executive that all Oranga Tamariki staff in care and protection residences were trained in the correct management of actual pain or potential aggression of or MAPA hold technique?
Mr. Speaker, yes, they were trained in those techniques, but whether they applied them in the appropriate way is another question.
What is the percentage of frontline staff at Oranga Tamariki who have completed the full MAPA training program?
Mr. Speaker, I would expect that anybody who works in the child care and protection residences would complete that training.
A point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, Debbie Naruapaka.
Thank you. I would ask that the Minister table the evidence to back up that the staff have been trained.
If the Minister had a document and quoted from it, she could certainly ask for it to be tabled, in fact require it to be tabled. I think when a Minister states his expectations, it is very hard to table what leads to that.
What percentage of workers in youth care and protection residences are trained and qualified social workers as opposed to other support staff such as youth workers?
Mr. Speaker, I think what's important is that we have in these care and in these residences that we have the right people with the right skills dealing with the children. Whether they're social workers or youth workers, it's irrelevant if they have the best interests of the children at heart.
I'm not sure through to the Speaker whether we got the answer, what percentage of workers
and
in youth care support.
Okay, and because the member's, you know, is still one of the relatively new team, there's a Speaker's ruling somewhere around 183, I think, which indicates that if the member wants a specific answer, then she's got to ask a specific question. You can't just ask a general question and expect the Minister to have a whole pile of details, even if it is related.
Thank you. When was Oranga Tamariki Child Protection Protocol last reviewed and updated?
Mr. Speaker, I expect Oranga Tamariki to regularly update all of their protocols, but there's one thing to have protocols, it's another thing to actually apply them, and this is what has obviously failed. And I'm not standing here making any excuses for the failings of Oranga Tamariki. What has gone on is totally unacceptable, and that's why myself and the Chief Executive, Sir Wira Gardner, are standing up and putting the children's best interests at heart. When we saw the video the other day, within 24 hours, the staff was stood down. Within 48 hours, that residence was closed. That's decisive action.
I just would like to go on record that the question was, when was the Oranga Tamariki's child protocol last reviewed?
And it certainly was addressed, and I am going to warn the member that having a running commentary about her dissatisfaction with answers is disorderly. And if she does it deliberately, it's highly disorderly. I'm going to be generous and take this as a learning moment. Question number 11, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Housing and asks, how, on a scale of 1 to 10, does she rate the government's delivery of its housing policies and commitments?
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Mr. Speaker, the member will need to be more specific. On her scale, is 10 the best? As in, this government has delivered 10 times more affordable houses through its programs than the previous national government delivered through the special housing areas. Or does she mean that 1 is the best ranking? As in, our government ranks number 1 in the number of building consents ever seen in New Zealand, which contrasts with the record of the previous government when annual consents almost halved after the global financial crisis. But then, Mr. Speaker, there are other numbers that are way off the 1 to 10 chart, like the 7,863 public housing places delivered since we became government, the most in a generation. Or is it the number of apprentices in the building and construction sector, 22,760 in May 2021, compared with 12,560 in May 2017? But, Mr. Speaker, we don't claim for perfection. We know that there is way more work to do after 9 years of inaction under the previous government, but we have an extensive work program underway. There is no quick fix. What is needed is a government committed to an active...
I think the member has addressed the question.
Supplementary. How many of the 16,000 new Kiwi Build homes promised for delivery in the first 3 years of the program have been built since the official count began on 1 July 2018?
Mr. Speaker, the member knows well that the Kiwi Build program was reset in 2019 when I became the minister. But, Mr. Speaker, I can tell that member that it is 10 times the number of houses for affordable home ownership delivered in the 3.5 years that we have been in government than the previous national government delivered over 9 years in government.
Supplementary. By what date does she anticipate the government delivering the 1,000 Kiwi Build homes it promised to build in the first year of the policy?
Mr. Speaker, I think the member needs to look at her questions. That is a reset program. It does not have that target. But I would invite the member to have a look at the dashboard that is publicly available on the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development site that we have built 1,000 Kiwi Build houses. They have been sold. This is 10 times the number of homes for affordable home ownership than the previous government managed over 9 years.
Can she confirm the government's biggest current Kiwi Build project of 176 homes at Ormiston Rise has gone into receivership? And by what date will those homes be completed?
Mr. Speaker, the member has previously asked questions about that, and we've already had this discussion on the floor of this House. So the answer is yes. The 173 homes, I think off the top of my head, will be delayed. That project is being worked through, and everybody is hopeful that those homes will still be delivered.
Does she think government housing policies are delivering when there are four times as many at-risk people on the State House waiting list as there were when the government came to office?
Mr. Speaker, at the risk of repeating the answer to my primary question, which I'm sure would test the Chair's patience on a Thursday afternoon, I do believe this is a government delivering, because this is a government that is finally building some public houses. The previous National Government not only did not build houses, but it flogged them off. So after 9 years in government, we ended up with 1,500 fewer public houses than they started with. That party should hang its head in shame.
Will she apologise to New Zealanders for the government's complete failure to deliver on its commitment to build 16,000 Kiwi Build houses by today? And if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, I think what that member has to realise that sometimes in politics, and I think members of her party should probably take note of this, that one of the difficult things to do when you get something wrong is to admit it. That is what we did with Kiwi Build. We reset it and we have been delivering. What I will continually apologise to New Zealanders for is the fact that we had a National Government who for 9 years delivered nothing in public housing.
Kia.
Question number 12, Vanushi Walters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Diversity, Inclusion and Ethnic Communities. What recent announcements has she made about improving outcomes for ethnic communities in New Zealand?
The Honourable Premier wrote a question.
This morning I launched the new Ministry for Ethnic Communities.
Order. We're not seals in here.
Mr. Speaker, we have over 213 ethnicities represented across Aotearoa. We collectively speak over 160 languages. Our ethnic communities make up nearly 20% of New Zealand's population. This is the first time, Mr. Speaker, that they will have this level of representation in the public sector. It's the first time that we will have a chief executive whose sole focus is lifting the well-being of our ethnic communities and who will have a seat at the top table. A ministry has been a long-held ambition of our ethnic communities, Mr. Speaker, and I'm proud to be part of a government that has heard that call and responded to it.
Supplementary, what are the key priorities for the new Ministry for Ethnic Communities?
Mr. Speaker, I was determined that the direction and the strategy of the new Ministry for Ethnic Communities would be shaped by the priorities of the communities it serves. And so we engaged with members of our diverse ethnic communities across Aotearoa to find out what was most important to them. That has then shaped the priorities of the new Ministry. As agreed by Cabinet, they are to take action to promote the value of diversity and improve inclusion, to ensure equitable provision of and access to government services for ethnic communities, to develop and support initiatives to improve economic outcomes for ethnic communities, including addressing barriers to employment, and to work to connect and empower ethnic community groups.
What will the new ministry mean for our ethnic communities?
Mr. Speaker, our government wants to ensure that New Zealand is a place where everyone can be and feel safe, valued and heard, have a sense of belonging and be able to participate fully. We know that there are opportunities, but that some groups are currently unable to access them. We've heard from our communities what those barriers are and where the opportunities lie. With the Chief Executive at the top table, the new ministry is well placed to make tangible changes through its own program of work and influencing decision making across government to ensure better outcomes for our diverse ethnic communities. Mr. Speaker, we know that there's more work to be done, and collectively we can make Aotearoa a fairer, safer and more cohesive society.
Melissa Lee.
To the Minister, how will the Ministry defer to the Office of Ethnic Communities currently operating, considering it will still be a, quote, and I quote the Minister, departmental agency of the DIA, as she said yesterday at Select Committee, as it is currently now?
Mr. Speaker, as I mentioned in my responses to previous questions, the main difference here is firstly that our government in the last term invested in strengthening the Office of Ethnic Communities, including its community engagement function, and increased its funding that goes to grassroots community organisations eightfold. This is the next step in the journey of creating a ministry, something that our communities have asked for more than a decade. For the first time, we will have a chief executive who will sit at the top table and be able to influence change. That is a significant difference that, while members across might sneer, our communities hold very strongly. In terms of it being a departmental agency hosted by the DIA, the only thing that they will share, that this new ministry will share with DIA, is the back-end corporate functions, like procurement, like HR policy, like finance policy. I strongly believe that being able to share those functions and not reinvent the wheel and actually focus the time, energy and resources on our communities will be beneficial.
Question to members. Question number one, Chris Pink.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the member in charge of the Rights for Victims of Insane Offenders Bill. What reports or reaction has she received recently in relation to the Rights for Victims of Insane Offenders Bill?
The Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have received feedback that it is callous and cruel for Labor to delay this bill when the current verdict
order. Is... The member will resume her seat. Well, are you going to let me rule first? Parliament took a decision yesterday, and the member has to make it absolutely clear, I'm making it absolutely clear to the member, that she does not have responsibility for Parliament's decision. She can only answer on questions for which she is responsible. Supplementary question, Chris Pink.
Mr. Speaker, the question was what feedback had she received? And if the feedback that the member has received includes criticism of a particular party for their perception of a bloc, then how is that out of order? Well, we've had plenty of references to political parties in question time today.
Sure. As was referred to, I think, earlier today or possibly yesterday in question time, having patsy questions which invite people in charge of bills to slag the opposition is out of order. Chris Pink. A point of order. I hope the member's not going to reflect on the ruling I've just made.
He
better not be.
Well, no, it's a fresh point of order. Is the position now that you can receive feedback from members of the public and reflect on members of the of our side of the House who aren't even here and call them inane, to quote you earlier, but members are not allowed to answer questions about feedback they've had in relation to other political parties.
I suggest one of the early things that the member should do is get a hearing or comprehension test as to my comments, and then he might want to come back. Chris Pink, does a member... No, I'm not going to continue with this. Does Chris Pink want a supplementary or not? Supplementary question, Chris Pink.
Supplementary. What are the members' hopes for the next steps for the Rights for Victims of Insane Offenders Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. That this bill will not be delayed further because the current verdict is insensitive and deeply upsetting to the needs and feelings of those who have lost a loved one, adding further pain to people who are already significantly traumatised. Thanks, Labor.
That concludes our questions.